Hello, I'm Richard Blanco and welcome to Inside Property. The Bank of England has announced a raise in interest rates to 0.5%, the first increase in a decade. In this programme, we ask what this could mean for the property sector and what might be lurking in the Chancellor's budget on the 22nd of November. And the return of council house building. Theresa May has announced £2 billion to build 25,000 council homes. Will this mean a return to growth for the social housing sector? And is it enough? Now that the dust has settled on conference season, we're going to analyse the housing offer from Conservative and Labour parties and ask, what could your property business look like in 2025? No politician's obfuscation on this programme, because here to shed light on all the darkest recesses of government and official opposition policy is Chris Norris, Policy Director for the National Landlords Association. I'm also delighted to welcome to the programme no-nonsense landlord and journalist, Victoria Whitlock from the Evening Standard. Responses to this interest rate rise, pretty much expected, wasn't it, Chris?
It was, although we've expected similar rises a few times over the last couple of years, and it's never happened. In fact, I got rather too fond of saying that rates could only go one way, only for them to be reduced again last year. So it's not a surprise, but it's probably about time.
And Victoria, potentially you've got several mortgages like me, have you? And they might be going up with this rise.
Yeah, I'm juggling mortgages. I'm very highly leveraged. And so anything like this does make you feel a little bit nervous, particularly at the moment, because we've also now got these tax changes, so we can no longer deduct the interest on our mortgages from our tax. So that makes a big difference. And we only need a small increase like this to feel everyone start feeling a little bit nervous. And I don't think that landlords are going to be able to get it back through increased rents, even if they wanted to, because I see that despite all the media hype, rents are softening, maybe even coming down in some parts of London. So, it makes me a little bit nervous to see this today, even though, as you say, it was expected and it is only a small increase.
It's interesting, really, to be talking about worries over interest rates when we're at 0.5%. I mean, certainly at the time I've been at the NLA, I've been long enough to remember 5.5%. And then our members talking to us about, you know, making sure their margins were on 9%. So it's interesting now to be talking about 0.5%. But you're quite right. I mean, this is a 0.25% hike. That's just shy of £21 per £100,000 worth of gearing, assuming you're tracking. And if you look particularly the NLA, we self-select slightly larger landlords probably compared to the rest of the market, but our members tell us on average they've got about £465,000 worth of mortgage debt. Now every year just this 0.25% will mean £1,162 extra in payments, and that isn't something we're going to get back either as a tax deduction anymore or by means of increasing rents.
Yes, and Victoria mentioned the tax changes. They seem to have slowed the housing market. I mean, certainly Halifax index is showing that there's a 4% change in house prices over the last year. Mortgage approvals down by 2.7% from July to August. New sales instructions are at an all-time low. We talked last time, Chris, about too many levers. Do you think this is another lever too far, and you know it's just going to slow the housing market down too much?
It's going to be interesting. I mean, you're right. There are so many different policy objectives and levers in play in the housing market at the moment. It's really difficult to identify the impact that any one measure is having. This is another change that we don't need right now. And my suspicion is actually this is just a correction for the reduction that we got immediately post the referendum last year. And I doubt, it could be famous last words, but I very much doubt we'll see much more increase over the next 18 months to 2 years. All of the other economic indicators seem to be slowing. We've got no wage growth, effectively. Okay, headline inflation is at 3%, but there's lots of other factors there that means that may not be a long-term trend. It's going to be really, really interesting to see what happens with the housing market. I'm not sure this is going to be the thing that tips it over the edge, but there's a lot at play.
And Victoria, of course, the big question is this the beginning of a series of rises? And I know the NLA has done research before on how many rises landlords could withstand. I think they've often asked, you know, could you withstand up to about 3.5%? How are you feeling about that? How many rate rises could you withstand if Chris is wrong and we do see more in the next couple of years?
I frequently am.
Yeah, I hope Chris is right. I really do. I'm okay. I could stand a few rate increases, But I think it will make me think about selling one property, one that I acquired most recently, because that's the one that I'm getting the least return on. And margins are very tight for all landlords. I think margins are very tight. You know, I think people are, I think we're making loads and loads of money, but the yield is very low. And so, you know, I will have to have a look again at my investments and think about whether to offload some because of this. Yeah.
Interesting. Yes, I've just taken out a 5-year fix, actually, which are exempt from the PRA changes on the stress tests, or at least it can be stress test at the pay rate. So I'm feeling a bit smug about that today. Yeah. And in fact, I've got a few mortgages that are linked to the standard variable rate, and many lenders still have standard variable rates of 5% or more. And I suspect they're not going to be putting those up for some time. So it may be a while before those mortgages that I have are affected. And interesting you say about landlords selling. NLA research says that 20% plan to sell within the next 12 months, although 15% plan to increase their portfolios. But that figure is a record number, Chris.
It is. I mean, I should caveat that by saying that 20% say they will sell some of their properties. I mean, exactly as Victoria said, you're looking at portfolios and you're working out where the efficiencies are. So we're seeing a lot of landlords selling property. We're seeing them sell quarter on quarter, I think an average of 0.9 of a property, if you can do such a thing. But that's how it's working out across the sample. What's really interesting, though, is if you look at the really long-term trend. I mean, we've been collecting this data for about 10 years now. We always had a net increase in our bit of the market, the middle of the market, landlords who were a little bit more established, but perhaps not the major institutions. There was always an increase of about 2-3, even at particular high points, up to about 5% over the course of every year in that bit of the market. We're now down to 0.06% growth, and we're projecting negative growth towards the end of the year. So It's not the bottom falling out of the market, and there's still an awful lot of good reasons to be a landlord and to be in the PRS, particularly if you compare that to the rates you might get on an ISA or another relatively low risk investment. But you know, people have had enough, quite frankly, and more landlords are now selling more properties than they're buying.
You're nodding vigorously there, Victoria. Tell me more.
I think we just feel that we're being attacked from every direction at the moment, and it's a really high risk investment and there's a lot at stake. And maybe I'm just feeling a bit down at the moment because I've got a property that I'm struggling to let and I can see that rents are falling, and that's okay. But on top of everything else, I just think it's tough times out there. I don't think it's the easy investment that people thought it was. I think it's a very long-term investment, and there's a lot of instability in the market right now, and so it's cause for concern.
I find myself deterring newbies from going into the business. A friend of mine, a very interesting case actually, her mother is giving her some money to buy a property, and she was going to try and buy a property for herself. She's found that 120,000 isn't enough of a deposit in London. She was thinking of buying to let outside of London, but she's been deterred by so many changes. What might be lurking in the budget, Chris? We had a few suggestions from Savid Javid at the Tory Party conference. Rabbits being pulled out of the hat comes to mind. Yep. He said that Section 21 might change, so the notice period could be 3 months, and he's keen for landlords to do the right thing by having longer tenancies, and hint, hint, there will be something in the budget.
Budgets fill me with absolute terror at the moment and have done for the last couple of years, and I think that's the case for lots of landlords. It's really interesting. Party conference season coming so close to the budget, now that we're having the budget in the autumn, means a real rush job for departments all up and down Whitehall. I went in to meet with the housing officials almost immediately after that speech, the couple of days after that speech, and I'm sure I'm not betraying any confidence in to say they were very nervous. They weren't entirely sure what all of those announcements meant. Some of them have been discussions, some of them have been the in vogue phrase at the moment is prototyped. They've been developed and developed into these prototype policies. But there was nothing that was really that close to fruition that they expected too many announcements. So it is going to be really interesting. You mentioned there the Section 21 issue. I think the government view that as a big part of a package that won't all come to fruition right away. And as you say, there's some talk of an incentive. We've been discussing these incentives with the government. We've been trying to get them to accept that there are costs to providing property, heaven forbid. And that if you're going to provide a riskier, longer term tenancy, you need to offset that risk in some way. Now, we know there's an acknowledgement in certain parts of the government that that could be some kind of tax relief or some kind of fiscal incentive. What I'm really cautious about is saying how beneficial it might be. It wouldn't surprise me at all for there to be a small tax benefit for offering longer tenancies. I'd be quite surprised at this point in time whether it'd be enough to make landlords want to consider it.
Yes, I mean, I've seen landlords throw their arms up in horror at the prospect of mandatory three-year tenancies. You know, we're handing over the keys to effectively a stranger, aren't we? And that, although, you know, all of the stats tell us that tenancies tend to last, on average, over 4 years now, I think is the figure. It's still a worry being forced to have a tenant for a minimum period of 3 years. Would you be prepared to do it for a tax incentive, Victoria?
No, I don't think I would, actually, not unless I was forced to. I mean, on the whole, I would love my tenants to stay for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. I've got the other problem that they leave too soon. But I don't want to be, like you said, I don't want to be forced to have a tenant, because what if something goes wrong? What if they don't pay the rent? So what I would like to see, if we are going to be forced or encouraged to offer longer tenancies, then I'd like to see a more efficient eviction process, not a faster. I don't think that we want to get to a situation where landlords can just chuck out a tenant if they don't like them, but I think that the system at the moment, from what everybody tells me, doesn't work very well. There's too much delay, there's not enough resources, so I think they need to make sure that eviction process is efficient, so that it removes some of the risk for landlords.
Well, that's an interesting point, isn't it, Chris? Because Savid Javid also said that he was going to consult on a specialist housing court.
Yeah, I mean, that's really echoed some of the conversations we've been having with the government over the last few months. Again, it's an announcement of a consultation with another government department that tells us they didn't know it was coming. So it could be quite a long-term programme they're talking about now. But I think what's really, really important, and we've made this point to government, is the sequence of all of these changes. I think if you take all of these in isolation, there's some good, there's some bad. You know, there's nothing, I don't think, as disastrous as some of the changes we've seen over the last few years. But they've got to be implemented in the right order. You know, we've been pushing for a long time for a reform of the court process for Section 8. You know, it can't be right that it takes on average 50 weeks to go from starting that process to actually getting a warrant and getting the property back. You know, the government has acknowledged that, but they're looking at quid pro quos. And the quid pro quo might be that Section 21 is used less, or perhaps has that longer notice period. Now, that's an anathema to most landlords. But I think if you offer them the choice of being able to use a really efficient, effective Section 8 process that actually gets you that money order that you need because you don't evict for no reason, or going through a slightly longer Section 21, they might take that bargain. My worry is it's easier to do the nasty bit than it is to do the real reform. And we'll see changes to Section 21 early, and we'll see a long, drawn-out consultation process on Section 8, and perhaps never quite get there because, let's face it, we don't have the most stable government at the moment, and we're not entirely sure what's going to be round the corner. I mean, I've got to say, with this budget coming up, my big concern is what might happen around stamp duty.
Yes, exactly. And there's been a lot of chatter about that in the press. There's been talk about whether it would be lowered for first-time buyers, whether the government will acknowledge that it's too harsh on buyers in that 1 million plus bracket. I know a lot of our listeners will probably not be too sympathetic with people in that bracket, but the idea is that a lot of people with properties that are more expensive than a million are reluctant to move, and that's helping to stagnate the market. And the idea is that if more people in that bracket did move, it could get the markets shifting. What are your thoughts on stamp duty, Victoria? Do you think it needs reform?
I honestly haven't given it too much thought, really, probably because I'm not thinking of buying anything at the moment. I wasn't actually opposed to the increase in stamp duty for property investors. I thought maybe that's fair enough, given that there is a feeling out there, I think, that landlords are snapping up properties away from first-time buyers. Maybe there needed to be some balance there. I think we have to have taxes. And therefore, maybe a property tax is a fair tax. You know, nobody likes taxes, do they? We don't want to pay any sort of tax. So maybe it's no less fair than other forms of tax.
Well, some would argue, of course, that it's ridiculous to have a tax on moving home. And also, it's interesting to note that stamp duty receipts have gone up by $2 billion or 20% since this additional stamp duty came in. Mm-hmm. So presumably the government's going to be rather reluctant to roll back on that one, Chris.
I think it's almost certain they won't roll back. My real concern is they might actually increase it. Now, I mean, and this is purely based on guesswork, and, you know, we've got no indication they might. But if you look at the figures across the last financial year, so 16-17, I think the 3% levy on its own brought in about £1.7 billion. And that was during a period where people were uncertain, didn't want to pay the levy, said, I'm not buying. Over the course of this year to date, so what, April to now, we're in November, it's brought in £1.2 billion. People are still buying. The transactions are back up above the rate they were in 2015. If I were the government now, and I were looking at a group that's not particularly popular, say private landlords, and I needed to fill a hole in my budget, I'd actually say our objective was to slow down this market. It hasn't slowed it down. It obviously wasn't high enough. Why don't we try 6%?
Wow.
I desperately hope they won't increase it, but it wouldn't surprise me one bit.
Okay, well, that's a rather grim thought, actually. And I was going to ask, you know, whether this dream quid quo pro of rolling back on Section 24 tax changes might be possible, but I suspect not.
I mean, I think we're going to really need to see and demonstrate the impact. I mean, the NLA, we remain as resolute that this is disastrous for the market and for the wider housing market. The difficulty is that we've got to wait to see what it does to receipts, to what it does to rent increases, and what it does to investment. If you had a fully functioning housing market, maybe it could accept some of these changes. At the moment, there's nowhere else for people to go, and there's only so much elasticity in rents. So we're going to see some pretty significant damage.
Well, let's move on to house building, and in particular, council house building. Theresa May has said the state must get back into the business of building subsidised rented homes, and she's committed $2 billion to build 25,000 council houses. The National Housing Federation said that this could result in between 50,000 and 60,000 if additional public and private investment were secured through that initial $2 billion from the government. How enthusiastic are you, Victoria, about more council house building?
Yeah, I feel really passionate about this, that we do definitely need more social housing. And I don't think that it should be down to the private rented sector to provide homes for the most vulnerable and the worst off in society. Those people don't get the security they want for various reasons from the private rented sector. And I speak from a personal point of view because I have a father with Alzheimer's who's very elderly and he's in social housing. If I would feel very uncomfortable if he was renting from a private landlord just because of the fact that he might be asked to move at any point, and with dementia that would be terrible for him. And also I've had tenants who are very vulnerable. They've clearly got mental health issues and I don't think they should be renting from private landlords because I haven't been able to take care of them. I'm not set up to take care of somebody like that. So we do definitely need more social housing.
It's interesting, isn't it, Chris? Because, you know, the PRS is trying to fill this gap left by social housing, which has shrunk down to 17.2%. The PRS now is at 20.1% of housing. And, you know, local authorities are trying to procure more properties from the private rented sector. The private rented sector is quite reluctant because, of course, the rents that are paid by local authorities are often lower than market rents. Is it better that council housing is built so that the PRS is not shoehorned into this area?
I mean, there's a need for a whole host of different types of property, types of tenancy, types of tenure. At the moment, you know, despite the fact that we seem to be so loathed by policymakers, we're also seen as a solution by policymakers, which is a very strange bargain, quite frankly. But Victoria's quite right. You know, there are people out there that need support that private landlords, particularly small private landlords who make up the majority of the market, are not geared up to do. I mean, even if you have a landlord who wants secure long-term tenancies, which, as we've mentioned, most people don't want their tenants to move on, we by and large don't have the skill set to support people with specific needs. And the thought that we might be able to, and you might get more and more vulnerable people living in the private rented sector, seems far from ideal for me. Social housing, yes, in certain parts of the country, it may take away some business from private landlords. If you look, for instance, in parts of the North East, if you look in Newcastle, there is an active market between private landlords and social landlords. There's actually more supply than demand. And, you know, we've got to up our game and certain places to make sure that we can compete and provide places that people want to live.
This has been welcomed by the local government association, but they want restrictions on councils borrowing to build new homes lifted. And of course, there's the irony today that we're starting to build more council homes just at a time when interest rates are starting to go up. And wouldn't it have been great if councils could have borrowed to build more when interest rates were low, don't you think, Victoria?
Yeah, I mean, it's a national disgrace, really, that councils sold off the council houses and then weren't able to build more. I mean, we're in this mess now because of that policy from decades ago. So, yeah, it's crazy.
How enthusiastic are you, Victoria, about Help to Buy? Because that was also announced by Theresa May. She said that £10 billion would be put in to help boost Help to Buy. She didn't put forward any more details. She said, again, it'd be outlined in the budget. But she said it would get another 135,000 onto the property ladder. And this is where the government gives either 20% or 40% loan to first-time buyers. And the first-time buyer just has to put in 5%. Seems to be fairly popular. The Home Builders Federation says it's helped 200,000 people buy newly built homes in the past 4 years.
Yeah, I did initially think it was a good initiative, particularly for young people who would otherwise not be able to get onto the housing ladder. But I wonder if it's increased house prices. Is that an effect? I don't know. I've heard rumblings about maybe that prices have gone up because of that, because people have got the money to spend now.
Well, Shelter and the Adam Smith Institute say it will push up house prices. Interestingly, the Labour Party says it would extend the scheme to 2027 if it came to power. There's some anecdotal evidence that it's reducing house prices of older stock in the Midlands and the North. What do you think of this policy, Chris?
I think the principle of helping people to buy makes sense. I mean, certainly from a political point of view, you know, we can all understand why all parties want to tap into aspiration. You know, very few people aspire to renting a property all of their life. They aspire to buy. Of course, you'd want to offer them something for that. I mean, my worry, or my deep concern, frankly, about the policy is what it indicates. It's indicative of an obsession from the government and successive governments about owner occupation. And I, because of what I do for a living, I spend a lot of time watching Parliament. I was watching PMQs last week, and a backbench MP, Bob Blackman, asked a question about a piece of work that the NLA is doing with Crisis and with him and his office to support people into rented housing, vulnerable people who can't raise a deposit. He asked a very clear, very straightforward question about policies to help raising rental deposits, to get people into homes. These are homeless people into homes. And the PM's response was all about how Help to Buy can help people raise deposits to buy homes. It's a completely different cohort, yet that's the go-to for the government.
I guess it's, you know, trying to deal with the generational problem of young people struggling to get on the housing market. You were shaking your head again vigorously,
yeah,
Victoria.
Because I think there's a stigma now about people renting. You know, it seems to be that if you don't own your own home, there's something wrong with you or you've failed. And that's not right, surely. I mean, maybe people think, oh, she's smug. She's sitting there owning several properties. She's got her own home. But do young people want to rush into buying a property? Should we be encouraging them to do that? Should they get settled first? Should they get established in their careers first? There does seem to be a national obsession with owning your own property. And it's not for everybody. And it's certainly not for very young people in the early part of their careers. And I think we're sort of almost making renting seem like people who rent seem like second class citizens. And that's not the case at all.
OK, well, you're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco, Chris Norris from the National Landlords Association and Victoria Whitlock from the Evening Standard. Now, I want to pose this question. What could your property business look like in 2025? We've got, you know, so many changes in the pipeline from the government and also lots of changes proposed by the Labour Party. Let's have a look at a few of these before we kind of look at that bigger picture of where our businesses might be then. We've got the draft tenants' fees bill, which has just come out, proposing caps on deposits of 6 weeks and not 4 weeks, holding deposits of 1 week, banning fees for granting, renewal or the continuation of a tenancy. And it's to be enforced by trading standards with civil penalties of up to £30,000. Any surprises in there, Chris?
Not especially. It's reassuring on one hand that the government has listened to us and others about the deposit cap. I mean, don't get me wrong, we're not particularly pleased to see a deposit cap at all, but 4 weeks was was limiting. There was this view that landlords were asking for extortionate deposits across the board 2-3 months. The argument that we've made really strongly with the government at the moment is that actually the norm has been 4.9 weeks, based on our data, but also the cases that have required larger deposits have been where there's a risk to the property, where you've got, you know, people who want pets, for instance. It's not the most important element in all of this, I know, but you know, everyone seems to agree that landlords should allow pets where possible. And I don't think there's too much of an objection to charging an extra deposit should you have a dog in a rented house, for instance. This would have prevented that. So I think that bit of leeway is quite welcome. The rest is pretty much as we expected.
A four-week cap on deposits would have really stuck in my gullet, actually, Victoria, because psychologically 6 weeks seems to be quite important, because sometimes tenants think that they can just not pay the last month's rent because that's then covered by the deposit. What do you think about the proposals?
Yeah, I think they're fair enough. I mean, I'm glad to see that we're going to have a ban on letting agents from charging tenants' fees, and also landlords who are charging little sneaky fees. I long thought that they were outrageous. I think it would have been damaging if they'd had a four-week cap on deposits, because, as you say, tenants often don't pay the last month rent, and I've just had that recently with some tenants, and it would have stopped you from taking the slightly riskier tenants, those that you might take a bit of a chance on at the moment. If you then were only allowed to take a four-week deposit, I think it would have meant that those tenants would have found it quite hard to find accommodation. So I'm pleased that they haven't gone ahead with that.
I'm interested to ask you, Victoria, about your experience with agents, because we're seeing quite a lot of regulation coming in now. They've got to be members of a redress scheme. There are the transparency regulations that they're now subject to. The government announced that they're going to have to join a trade body. There's also going to have to be client money protection for any kind of rents and deposits that they hold. Do you think this is overdue? Or
I think it's long overdue. And come on, they're not going to starve. They're going to be fine. Don't let's have any bleeding hearts for letting agents, right? Right now, they will be fine. They'll find a way of making money and making it work. Maybe they'll offer less fizzy water. I don't know. But, you know, their fees had got out of control and they weren't transparent. It's the fact that they were being sneaky about their fees. Not all agents, but a lot of agents had jumped on the bandwagon. So I think it's overdue and I think it's good. And I think it'll be good for letting agents as well, because to be more professional is a good thing. And I spoke to an agent recently who was saying that they're not getting tenants coming through the door anymore, because tenants are starting to want to rent direct from landlords and avoid the agents, partly because of the fees, but partly because they don't feel they're getting a very good service for the money that they're paying. So I think it'll be good. I think it's good to make them more professional, to make them more transparent, and then I think the tenants will start to go back to agents.
Are we expecting much bleating from agents, Chris?
Oh, I think you can always expect quite a lot of bleating from any industry, let's be fair, that has regulation thrown at it. But I think Victoria's quite right. There's an interesting debate going on at the moment, I think, in the letting agent industry about, you know, what's fair, what's not, what regulation is needed. And, you know, in defence of letting agents very, very slightly, the good end of the market has been pushing for this regulation for just as long as the rest of us. The fees issue has been a little bit more complicated for them, but I think they're coming round to the notion of what needs to happen. The question that we as a landlord's body have really been asking letting agents is, how confident are you in the service you're providing? Because I think the questions that we're asking are, well, firstly, why were you charging tenants that much anyway when I've paid my 10 or 15% commission and you've charged me for the agreement and you've charged me for the renewal? And you've probably charged me for the fizzy water as well, quite frankly. So the questions are being asked about that service level. And some are doing a really good job in answering that question, and some are being found really wanting. I think what we've got to watch, and we've got to be very clear that all of these announcements have come out, but actually we've probably got about 2 years before we see most of this come to fruition. We've had a draft bill published, which, you know, it's not even a piece of primary legislation yet. It's got to go through a separate process before it can be reintroduced again. There will be debate, there will be consultation, there will be argument, and then it will start its process proper to becoming law. So we're probably looking at 2019 and the tail end of 2019 before we see this. What's going to be really interesting is how the industry adapts first, because if they wait for the cliff edge, particularly if you're looking at something like client money protection insurance, which, like any insurance, comes with a lot of due diligence and a lot of underwriting standard. If the agencies out there who are in the grey areas or the borderline of good practice, don't adapt now, we're going to see people falling off the cliff, and that's going to hurt a lot of tenants and a lot of agents. So the objective, I completely agree with. We've just got to be very careful how the movement from unregulated to a regulated service is managed to make sure people don't fall out the sides.
Yes, and I wonder if we will see a thinning out of high street letting agents. I know when pressure to comply was put on agents in London Borough of Newham, we did definitely see numbers go down as agents kind of left the market. The other rabbit that was pulled out of the hat at the Tory Party conference is a redress scheme for landlords, and my immediate thought was, how much is that going to cost? And I wasn't very keen on it initially, but then I thought, you know, if agents have to be in redress schemes, then maybe landlords should as well. What do you think, Victoria?
Yeah, I'm not opposed to this, but what I would like to see, and I'm not sure how this would work, is better education for landlords, because I think there are a lot of very well-meaning landlords out there, but they're perhaps not well-informed. And if we could have some sort of scheme that maybe like a national register that all landlords have to sign up to, and then as a result of signing up, they're automatically sent all the information that they need to be compliant, so all the rules, regulations around letting, then that would probably be better. When I was speaking to Generation Rent, they were saying that it's landlords like me that they don't like, actually, because we don't know all the rules and regulations, and we don't know all the rules and regulations. And so although organisations like the National Landlords Association are probably doing a very good job of educating landlords, the landlords have to go to them to want to get educated, and you don't know what you don't know, so you don't necessarily go to those organisations to find out about these things. So that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see some compulsory education of landlords.
Well, of course, that is the case in Wales, that anyone who manages property has to be accredited and licensed. And could we see this proposal that agents must be members of trade bodies mirrored amongst landlords? I mean, 1.7 to 2 million of us, aren't they, Chris? That's a lot of members.
It would be a lot of members. That's, I suppose, from a commercial point of view, something we'd welcome.
Ka-ching!
Whether those members would welcome it, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think we've got to be careful that we understand exactly what comes with some of these schemes. I think if we're talking about a registration scheme where landlords can be identified, where they can be sent information, where they can be signposted towards the NLA, for instance. And we run these very accreditation and foundation courses, which I'd love to see more landlords like yourself attend and see what's out there. I think the danger is when it slides into something more akin to licensing.
Yeah.
And that's when I think a lot of landlords would object. And you've got to be really careful about the benefit. A registration scheme, and we're quite fond of saying, actually, every landlord is already registered on numerous databases. It just requires someone, probably in government, to say, actually, let's bring them all together. If you're paying tax, you're on one database with HMRC. If you've got a gas boiler, you're on another one with the Gas Safe Register. If you've protected a deposit, you're with My Deposits or one of the other schemes. All this data's out there. We're all already registered. Let's just bring it together and let it work. I mean, the redress schemes will be another one. And I've got to admit, my reaction was exactly the same as yours, Richard. What will this cost, and how much will we be made to pay for it? I'm hoping that it can be organised in a polluter pays model. You know, everyone could register with a redress scheme, but only actually pay when you need their services. I think would be the absolute goal for us. But we do need to be quite clear, and I'm not entirely sure the government's that clear about what redress and ombudsman do. There's a lot of discussion at the moment about, oh, it'd be great, we can take all of our rent arrears and our maintenance disputes to the ombudsman. It's not what they exist for. I mean, an ombudsman or redress scheme exists for a service level failure. It's why it's so important with letting agents. If something in your T&Cs with the agent isn't right, you go to the ombudsman. If you've not complied with your statutory obligations, you go to court. And that will always be the case. So I think we've got to be quite clear. And that's why, as a body, we're not too concerned right now about the potential costs of redress, because the service level elements of landlord and tenant, or crucially landlord and letting agent, I think are less than people perhaps think they are.
Well, let's take a look at some of the proposals from the Labour Party. Some of them came out in the conference. Cities are to have rent control powers, potentially. Mandatory three-year tenancies, an inflation cap on rent rises, with ominously additional security in London or additional powers given to the Mayor of London. Now, we don't have much detail on what these rent controls might look like. Do you think that landlords have much to fear from those sorts of proposals, Victoria?
Well, again, it's going to make us feel a little bit nervous, isn't it? I think we have to look at what the proposals are. We need the detail. We need to find out. I mean, there are too many people out there now complaining that the rents are too high and that there are problems in the private rented sector. So I think we have to engage. We have to listen. We have to find ways of making people feel happier about renting. So I wouldn't rule them out of hand. But of course, you're nervous when you don't know what it is that you're what's coming up. And we don't know. They just keep throwing out these phrases, rent controls, rent caps. But what does that mean? How will it work?
Yes, I mean, Chris, do you think it's more likely to be controls on rent rises, a bit akin to the rent pressure zones scheme in Scotland? I believe Edinburgh and Glasgow have already said they'd like to bring in rent pressure zones where there'd be a cap on the rises. So the contract would begin at a market rent, but then there'd be a cap on annual rises. Do you think we're likely to see that sort of scheme?
I suspect we are more likely to see what they call second or third generation rent controls. So yes, the market plays a role, and then there are caps on increases or caps on changes. I think there's still a lot to be worried about, though. I mean, if we're talking about what the Labour Party could do after some hypothetical election, the Labour Party have been reviewing housing policy for 7 years. And all we get are the odd soundbite about, wouldn't it be great if we have rent control? You know, the NLA is completely non-political. We sit down with ministers, shadow ministers, spokespeople from any party, and we can barely get through the door with the Labour Party at the moment. And I think that's in part because there really isn't much of an evidence base behind some of the rhetoric. We would love to see some more policy. We probably won't agree with it, but I'd love to see some more certainty on what that policy could be, because we have to face up to the fact that, you know, I'm in no position to predict who the next Prime Minister will be. I'm not sure many people out there are. And, you know, we as an industry need to prepare for whatever contingency might come along.
Well, some landlords would argue that Corbyn's just on generation rent side, and the lack of discussion about landlords and what could happen to them in the Labour Party is because they just don't want to work with us. Do you feel like that, Victoria?
Well, I don't know him very well. I can't comment on that, but I think there's a lot of media hype out there around landlords and rents, and Generation Rent have done a very good job of getting their point across. I think they've gone overboard personally, but I don't know what Jeremy Corbyn is thinking at the moment. Who does?
Well, there are also these proposed changes to corporation tax that would go up to 26%, and talk of renationalising some industries. One landlord said to me the other day that he's starting to look at his property business and prepare it for a possible Corbyn premiership. And I'm not quite sure what sort of preparations he could make. What are your thoughts, Chris?
I'd love to know what preparations he's doing, because we probably need some pointers as well as to what it might be. I mean, it's interesting. Normally, you wouldn't imbue so much influence, or you wouldn't imbue one person with so much influence. You know, we've had quite a few party leaders in my time at the NLA, and there's always a process. I mean, it's the shadow housing secretary of state, but there isn't a housing secretary of state, so I'm not sure who he shadows at the moment, is John Healey. John Healey was a minister of state for housing in the last Labour government, who the NLA worked with really constructively. I worked with really constructively. I've been here long enough to remember quite a few governments now for the NLA. If he has got a hand on the tiller when it comes to housing policy, you know, there'll probably be some things a lot of landlords don't like very much, but I wouldn't say it'll be quite as radical as we're assuming because of all this hype about Jeremy Corbyn. On the other hand, Jeremy Corbyn is one member of parliament that the NLA met with almost every year prior to him becoming leader of the Labour Party, because he introduced the same private members bill every year, looking to heavily regulate the private rented sector. So it is something that he personally has quite a lot invested in terms of his ideology rather than properties, I'm sure. So it's really, really unpredictable at the moment.
Well, Well, let's peer into that crystal ball now and look at what our property businesses could look like in 2025. So presumably we would have had potentially two elections before then. Brexit may or may not have completed. Maybe the private rented sector will have shrunk, or, you know, maybe it will have sustained itself at the same level or even grown. Maybe the social sector will have grown again. Where do you see your business then, Victoria?
I think it'd be very worrying if the private rented sector has shrunk in that time, because where are all those people going to live then? So I wouldn't like to see that. But personally, I think that I will have reduced my tiny portfolio even further. I think, like you were saying, the landlord is preparing for a Corbyn, possible Corbyn government. I think I am also kind of thinking that wouldn't be a good thing for landlords necessarily. And so I would be looking, I think, to offload one or two properties by then.
And I'm kind of confused about the whole thing, because I sense that, you know, house prices might start to slide a little bit, and we're probably nearer the end of the housing cycle in terms of prices than we are the beginning. So I had always thought that, you know, prices would be on the up again in the 20s, and that might be a time to start to sell one or two properties. But Brexit has really changed things, and, you know, I don't think things are as clear anymore. I'm also really frustrated that the Labour Party are not engaging more with landlords and embracing the good work that we do, because I feel like there's a lot of landlord bashing going on, really, in Labour Party thinking. Where do you see our businesses going in the next 8 years or so, Chris?
Traditional thinking has said for quite some time that by 2020, the PRS will be about 25% of housing stock, then levelling out a little. I think that the ceiling for the nationwide figure was always capped at about 30%. People didn't think we'd get beyond that unless there was the bottom completely fell out of social housing and people started selling up their unoccupied property. My suspicion is nationwide, because it's skewed a bit by London, we'll still look at about a quarter of all housing stock. But it's really important to consider where you are in the country, you know, particularly if we're talking about what happens to the value of that stock and what the yields look like. You've already got, well, more than a north-south divide. You could probably divide the country up into quadrants, but you've already got the southeast of the country looking almost purely to capital appreciation. And as you say, if we're at the end of this part of the cycle, there could be quite a major impact there. If you look towards the northeast and the northwest, for instance, there are lots and lots of parts of the country that have never recovered from the credit crunch in terms of property value, and it's all about yield. Now, playing devil's advocate, you could say that if you had a government that introduced more security and you were completely interested in rental yield, and you had a system that incentivised year-on-year capped rent increases, you might be doing okay. And it might be the birth of a completely different type of private rented landlord. It might be more of this hybrid that we hear about more from continental Europe. If you're a landlord in London, I think it looks much, much worse. Because one thing we've not mentioned is there's a lot of talk about restricting investment from overseas. And one thing I would expect to see from a changing government would be some kind of restriction on money pouring in from the Middle East, from China, and buying up property to leave it empty in London, which we as an organisation don't talk about a lot because it's not being a landlord. But it does bolster prices. So I think depending on where you are, you might have very different views. I think either way, it's going to be quite uncertain. But on the brighter side, it's probably still not going to be a terrible place to have your investment.
Well, that could be music to the ears of Scottish landlords who are, of course, looking at lifelong tenancies from December, I believe.
On the 1st of December, yeah.
Yes, so... prospects good or bad for London landlords, Victoria? Should we be quaking in our boots?
I don't think I'm experienced enough or have enough knowledge to say, and I don't want to freak everyone out. But quaking in our boots, maybe no. Maybe that's an exaggeration. But I think you always have to have an eye to the future. You have to plan 2 years ahead at least. You have to look at your business plan. You have to keep reassessing. And I think now is a good time to assess your properties in your portfolio and look at what might happen with interest rates. Look at what's happening already with Brexit. You know, I depend quite a lot on immigrants coming in. I take a lot of tenants who are from Eastern Europe. I'm seeing fewer of those already. So we have to sort of keep your eye on the ball, really, and consider what you're going to do 2 or 3 years ahead.
Very good advice to end the programme on. Thank you very much to my guests, Victoria Whitlock and Chris Norris. And thank you very much to you for listening. Please do go to insideproperty.org.uk for useful links and to get in touch. Inside Property is produced in collaboration with the National Landlords Association.